It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Women are running for office in record numbers in 2018 on local and national levels. Many of them are military veterans. Many of them are Democrats. And they are conveying a message that they are fed up with how things are going in this country. So how might women govern differently? Even if half of the 185 women who have won nominations to Congress win, will that change the makeup of the entire organization? We're taking your calls on this. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email. You could tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kelly Dittmar is an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University Camden, and she's a scholar at the Center for American Women in and Politics at the Eagleton Institute of Politics. She joins us now to suss out why all these women are running and what impact they may have. Kelly, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So more women have been nominated for the U.S. House and for gubernatorial seats across the country this election cycle than ever before in history. What are these numbers and how many nominees are there?
Sure. So for the U.S. House, as you noted, we have 185 nominees as of today. And historically, the record was 165. That we had set in the last cycle. But to give some important context, obviously, we have about 14 primaries left. So we expect that that record won't just be broken, but kind of really be shattered by the end of the cycle in terms of the number of women who will appear on a ballot this fall. For the gubernatorial offices, our record number of nominations prior to this year was 10. We're at 11 as of today. As you know, in Wisconsin and in other states, we have the opportunity to potentially add more women to that list. And so we'll be watching to see how far we surpass the record at that level. And then in the Senate, we do expect that we will exceed that record. We just haven't done so yet, or that we'll get close.
And Gretchen Whitmer from our neighboring state of Michigan was somebody who won a primary on Tuesday. She is a Democrat running for governor.
So we have, the possibility in Michigan of electing the second woman governor. One thing to note in all of these numbers is that Democratic women do outnumber Republican women both as filed candidates and as nominees, so also true of what we saw in Michigan. Of the gubernatorial nominees we selected thus far, 8 are Democrats and 3 are Republicans. Importantly, among those Democrats, we also have 4 women of color, so 50% of our Democratic nominees for governor across the country this year are women of color. They all have the potential to be the first woman of color ever elected as a Democratic governor in the U.S., which, you know, every time we say these sort of firsts, we think, you know, that's great, we're breaking through, but also how has it taken so long?
So what is behind this surge of female nominees, do you think? Is it the Me Too movement?
You know, I think that there are a lot of stories. One thing we have to be careful about is we're talking about hundreds of women running for office, at least at just the federal and statewide level. So they come with really diverse stories about why they're running, their path to office, just as men would. For some women, Me Too, I think, and the conversation around the gender balance of power in our institutions probably was either motivating or just energizing. They were trying to make the decision about having the support they needed to run or making their voice heard, which is part of what Me Too really has done to empower a lot of women. But I also think the 2016 election catalyzed many women who had been engaged in advocacy and activism, but thought that there was a sense of urgency after the election, particularly if they were progressive women who felt that the policies they cared most about were under fire by both the administration in the White House as well as the Congress. So I think that may have also motivated particularly progressive women to run.
So that motivated women to run, but there are a lot of women who are working, volunteering for them and voting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that the dynamics of that motivation probably are similar, right? We know that women, when we do studies of women and we ask about their political participation, their strongest motivator is policy issues. You know, they care deeply about something and they're concerned the direction in which that policy is going in. And so the women who are on the ground protesting, giving money, volunteering, I think there's a similar function happening. They see the policy changes that are happening in government, and they're unhappy and concerned not only about how it will affect them, but how it will affect their communities, their families, children. And so they're speaking up, standing out, and making sure that they get people at the policymaking table that will present their values and perspectives and experiences.
We are talking to Kelly Dittmar of the Center for American Women in Politics. As of Tuesday, a record number of women are running for Congress in 2018 and other offices like governor and mayor and city council. So how might women govern differently, and why is this surge of female candidates happening? We're taking your calls for the next few minutes, 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So some women are not just running as politicians, but explicitly as female politicians. How is that an effective strategy right now?
Yeah, I think what you're seeing this year is women be sort of more authentically themselves. Historically, in American politics in particular, an institution that has really been dominated by white men, the idea was that women had to adapt to fit the mold of what a politician looked like and what they sounded like. What we're seeing this year, and we've seen over decades slowly change, but I think with the high number of women running in the context in which they're running this year, women are much more willing to talk about the distinct attributes that they bring, the values and credentials that they bring as women who've lived their lives as women in this country, which is distinctly different than men. To say that those experiences and those perspectives are a value added, not hurdles that they have to overcome in order to be successful in politics. That's a game changer, because not only does it change our perceptions of what politicians look like or what credentials we value in our politicians as voters, but I think it also may inspire and encourage other people to run in the future, because it expands the notions of who can be accepted and included as candidates in our political institutions. So I think we have to think about success for women candidates this year is not only about winning or losing on election day, but also how are they disrupting these notions of candidacy, of gender, and what effect will that have for expanding that candidate pool for years to come.
So one of the things that I think is interesting is that many female candidates are talking about their personal experiences with sexual assault and harassment in this post-Me Too era. Who's the audience for this, and are people responding to this honesty?
Yeah, so I think we have some limited information about the actual response, but I think the audience, from what we've seen from surveys about gender equality and sexual harassment, some of which my colleagues have written about for our project Gender Watch 2018, is really in the primary, particularly progressive voters, particularly progressive women, who are the ones who report being sort of most concerned about this as an issue, and who can empathize and see this as a systemic issue that needs to be addressed by those in politics. Where it doesn't resonate as much is with Republican voters. Mm. Even though Republican voters do see it as a problem, I want to be careful about that. It's not that they don't care about sexual harassment or think it's problematic, but their perceptions about whether or not it needs to be dealt with in a systemic way through public policy, through government, is slightly different. So I think as you get into the general election, where candidates are trying to appeal to a broader voter base, you may see somewhat less of that sort of messaging than you did in the primaries. And we've already seen less of that in Republican primaries than we have in Democratic primaries.
So in 2016, Democrats were criticized because they were using identity politics. They fell more into identity politics, as well as the idea that minorities and women vote for Democrats by default. But now we have candidates who seem to be using identity politics to win. Are we seeing this wrong here?
I think we have to really problematize or interrogate what we mean by identity politics. If we're talking about how candidates use gender, for example, or race in campaigns, there is no doubt that Donald Trump, the Republican at the top of the ticket, was using identity politics in that definition in 2016. He was probably, you know, campaigning as the most masculine candidate that we've seen for president in a couple cycles. He clearly tried to sort of bait on race. So Republicans have used identity politics. So I think we have to look at both the ways in which Republicans, Democrats, men and women, use, navigate, talk about gender and race in campaigns and not pretend that it only happens among people who are not white and among candidates who are not men. I think this year there are ways in which you're seeing candidates embrace identity, not as a biologic or demographic difference in and of itself, but to say that my identity as a woman, my identity as a person of color, brings with it a distinctive experience and perspective. That's the value added. That's why you can use it as a credential, because it's something that contributes to our conversations, to deliberation around public policy. We know that at diverse policymaking tables where there are different voices, you get better results. And I think that's what candidates, particularly those who are talking explicitly about their distinct demographic backgrounds, are trying to hit on this cycle.
So one more question here. I want to hear from Dana Nessel. She's a candidate for Attorney General in Michigan. She's talking about her campaign ad, which explicitly states that people should vote for her because she's a woman. And as a woman, she can be trusted to not expose herself to colleagues, unlike her male counterparts. Mm-hmm. Here's Nessel on CNN.
I knew it would capture people's interest and their attention. I didn't think I'd end up being on late night TV.
She said in the ad, "Who can you trust most not to show you their penis in a professional setting? Is it the candidate who doesn't have a penis? I'd say so." So is that going a little too far, Kelly?
Well, I think it is. I would say in most cases we don't see people be so literal about their gender, right? Again, I will say the president did talk about the size of his manhood on a debate stage in the last election, so this isn't new. But hers is kind of the extreme case. What you see most often, and in the messages you saw in the Wisconsin gubernatorial race with Kelderoy's ad breastfeeding, it's not about vote for me because I'm a woman. It's vote for me because I have an experience as a mom. I know what it's like to breastfeed and be concerned about BPA in my kids' bottles, right? Mm-hmm. That is the way in which I think is most effective for women candidates in particular, but also other candidates, to tie their distinctive experiences as women or with some unique background to what they will do in office, not necessarily what they can't do, but what they will do and how they will make that office and how they will make public policy better because their voices are there.
So what, right after Trump's inauguration, the day after Trump's inauguration, millions, tens of millions of women, mostly women, marched around the world in protest. Is a lot of what we're seeing now kind of the result of that? People got angry, people protested, then they had to figure out what they wanted to do next, and the answer was run for office.
Yeah, thankfully, I do think that's part of what happened. We've been working at the center, we've been around for nearly 50 years, to try to get women who are highly engaged in their communities and concerned about policy to take that sort of activism and advocacy and translate it into candidacy. And it's been tough because we've had to make a case to women that it's worthwhile to do so, that they can get things done if they get into politics. And this year, what we've seen is women who are angry, who are upset, who are concerned, instead of just protesting from the outside, which is important and they continue to do, they also have clearly seen the value of being at those tables, of being in those institutions. And so that translation has happened, at least to a certain degree, and has really changed the game to have more women who are willing to run. I also think within the context of Women's March and sort of backlash and resistance, what it has also done is inspired other people to look to women, right, as leaders in this movement, and to say, we want you to run. And so we know also historically that encouragement also matters more for women than for men in making the decision to run for office. And I think the marches alone, but also individual conversations and work within communities have led to that type of encouragement of women. Because after the election, I think there was a recognition that not only were women leading here, but they were also underrepresented in all of the halls of power, including in politics, and that we needed to do something to remedy that.
We have been talking to Kelly Dittmar. Kelly is the assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University, Camden, and a scholar at the Center for American Women in Politics at the Eagleton Institute of Politics. There have been a record number of women who are running. Kelly, in about 15 seconds, I want you to tell me how many you think are going to win.
We don't make predictions very well in political science or at COP, but I will say this. We will have a lot to work to do after this election cycle. While we're going to see gains this cycle, I'm optimistic about that. We're not going to get close to 50%, which would be parity in American politics. So I hope that we'll continue the energy well beyond this election year to be sure that more women run and more women win for the decades to come so that we do get closer to 50%.
Thank you for joining us, Kelly.
Thank you.
Next up, we are going to explore the trauma that's part of the job for firefighters and other first responders. It's the morning show. Thank you for sticking with us. I'm Carrie Kaufman.